Nuclear collusion. It's reasonable to expect that the regulatory agency tasked with maintaining the safety of nuclear sites would do just that, with an eye to long-term protection of people and the environment. Which is why it is so upsetting, but not unexpected, to discover that there is long-standing entrenched collusion between the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, the military, and the nuclear industry to, let's just say, not be upfront with the dangers posed by more than one nuclear site. It takes a dedicated reporter to uncover and document the full story, especially when it comes to a little-known radiologically contaminated site in Northeast Ohio. And when he explains the rationale behind covering up or minimizing the dangers created at the site and tells you,
there is a really bad case of regulatory capture going on at the EPA, regardless of which party occupies the White House, the big polluters and the military that are responsible for the toxic waste at these Superfund sites across the country. And they don't want to have to pay for the more expensive and time-consuming cleanups. So if they can cut corners with crooked science and data manipulation to show that the toxic contaminants, whatever they may be, are below maximum contaminant levels, then they can get a quicker corner-cutting cleanup over a much costlier, much more time-consuming proper cleanup.
Well, when reporter Greg Schwartz explains the rationale for nuclear cover-ups and data manipulation by the EPA, and his claims are backed by award-winning articles and extensive verifiable footnotes, and he follows up with the fact that the EPA is not putting our health and safety ahead of irresponsible corner-cutting on behalf of military savings and nuclear industry profits, you see once again the invasive nature of that awful, deadly, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with reporter Greg Schwartz. He has been covering the cover-up of nuclear radiation dangers at the Industrial Excess Landfill Superfund site in Northeast Ohio, which led him to discover parallel problems with the former Hunters Point Naval Shipyard Superfund site in San Francisco, and beyond that, the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant near San Luis Obispo. All three have major cover-ups in place, and Schwartz has connected the dots to uncover a pattern of EPA not protecting the public from these radiologically contaminated sites. We will also have nuclear news from around the world. Alistair Burnett of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons with the ICAN update, where he reports on the latest progress on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, and lots more honest and verifiable nuclear information, all of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, April 21st, 2026, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. This is a story that just broke late yesterday. U.S. President Donald Trump was allegedly blocked from access to the country's nuclear codes by a senior U.S. military chief. This, according to retired CIA analyst Larry Johnson on a popular YouTube show, Judging Freedom,
hosted by former Fox TV news analyst Andrew Napolitano, and that during an emergency meeting on Saturday, April 18, Trump tried to access the nuclear codes. One report coming out of that meeting at the White House is that Trump wanted to use the nuclear codes, and General Dan Crane stood up and said no. He invoked his privilege as the head of the military, so to speak. It was apparently quite a blow-up. There were some very bizarre things going on in D.C. These claims have not been confirmed, and the White House has denied them. And it's interesting that every story I accessed this included the phrase, "It is unclear what the nuclear codes would be used for should they be accessed." Well, there's only one thing that the nuclear codes can be used for, and that's to launch a nuclear weapon. This report comes following other reports that Donald Trump was barred from the Situation Room by military advisors during a critical Iran rescue operation. The U.S. president was reportedly shut out of discussions amid concerns about his furious temperament. Top administration officials believe his volatility could compromise the operation. General Dan Crane is the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And while Donald Trump, as president of the United States, has sole, undeniable, unstoppable access to the nuclear codes and the ability to launch with no other approval needed, it appears that perhaps there can be a limit to his ability to access them. If we get any updates on this story, we'll share them with you on next week's show. Now, here's the head of media for the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN. Alistair Burnett is reporting from ICAN headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland, with our monthly update on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, or TPNW. In this report, Alistair includes interviews with Hans Christensen, director of the Nuclear Information Project at the Federation of American Scientists, and Grete Ostern of Norwegian People's Aid and the lead author of the Nuclear Weapons Ban Monitor.
Hello, this is Alistair Burnett at ICAN in Geneva with an update from the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. As we all know, President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu have justified their illegal war of aggression against Iran by saying they had to stop an imminent threat from Iran, which they claimed, without evidence, was on the brink of developing a nuclear weapon. They made this claim despite President Trump having said the US and Israel had obliterated Iran's nuclear program in the bombing last June. Also, even US intelligence agencies, as well as the nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency, assess that Iran does not have an active nuclear weapons program. The war has had a huge economic impact around the world, particularly in Asia, where fuel prices have rocketed and products like fertilizers that are derived from oil are also becoming scarcer and more expensive. At the time of recording, the bombing of Iran has been paused while attempts are made by the US to find a negotiated way out of the war, which Trump clearly expected would be short and decisive. Israel, that had continued its attacks on Lebanon and Gaza, has done what Trump asked and stopped bombing Iran for the time being. At the beginning of April, most worryingly for those of us who campaign to eliminate nuclear weapons, Trump issued a threat to destroy Iranian civilization in one night. This has been interpreted by many as an implicit threat to use nuclear weapons against Iran, given that it's the only weaponry the US has that could do such a thing. As such, it has merited the all-out condemnation that came from many quarters. Given how unpredictable Trump is, it's impossible to know how this conflict will end. In further death and destruction or negotiation. Soon, the members of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, will start their 11th review conference at the UN in New York. These conferences are held every 5 years and are meant to take stock of progress in implementing the treaty. The problem for the NPT is there hasn't been an agreed outcome at one of these conferences since 2010, and there's little reason to expect one this time either. ICAN, along with other international and American civil society organizations, will be there to ensure our voice is heard. We'll be urging the five original nuclear weapons states, Britain, China, France, Russia, and the US, who are members of the NPT, to honor the commitment to disarm they made when they joined the treaty. We'll also be calling on other countries, particularly in Europe, that are legally bound not to acquire nuclear weapons or encourage their spread to stop their actions that are doing just that by talking openly about the need to increase dependency on nuclear weapons or even develop their own. At the end of last month in Geneva, ICANN's partner, Norwegian People's Aid, launched the 2026 edition of the Nuclear Weapons Ban Monitor. This annual report, that is produced by NPA in conjunction with the Federation of American Scientists, looks at the number and types of nuclear weapons in the world and how compatible each country is with the provisions of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, the TPNW. This year's report makes for grim reading. The number of nuclear weapons in the world available to be used is increasing again for the first time since the aftermath of the Cold War. There are now over 9,000 warheads available for use, and over 4,000 of these are deployed on ICBMs, submarines and air bases ready for use. On the TPNW, the Ban Monitor reports that 99 countries have either signed or ratified the treaty already, and there are more than another 40 whose policies are compatible with joining. The problem continues to lie with the 9 nuclear-armed states. That's the original 5, plus India, Israel, North Korea and Pakistan, but also with their allies who support the use of nuclear weapons in their security doctrines. Most of these are the European members of NATO, but also include Australia, South Korea and Japan under the so-called US nuclear umbrella, and Belarus that's allied to Russia. After the press conference to launch the Ban Monitor, ICANN spoke to Hans Christensen, director of the Nuclear Information Project at the Federation of American Scientists, and he told us what's driving this new trend.
The large nuclear weapon states are at each other's throats and very aggressive about their nuclear policies, and increasingly so. So with that comes added risk, not only for things to go wrong with nuclear weapons, but also, of course, that momentum, that dynamic is going to speed up. It used to be what they called rogue states and states of concern, as they used to name them, that were driving, after the end of the Cold War, they were driving this nuclear issue. There was a concern about proliferation. That's no longer the case. They have completely gone into the background. Now it is predominantly the large nuclear weapon states. And most of those were also the countries that drove the Cold War. It's Russia today, and it's China, and it is North Korea. It is the United States, and now we're seeing also steps from France and Britain that they're going to increase their arsenals. So this is in addition to what India and Pakistan are doing. So things are just going great.
We also spoke to the Ban Monitor's lead author, Greta Austin, of Norwegian People's Aid. She told us these trends are increasing the risk nuclear weapons will be used.
More than 40% of all the warheads that are available for use are loaded on delivery vehicles, on the launchers. And that means that they are ready for use now. And that clearly increases risk, because it means that they are out there, around us. The submarines are sailing in the waters 24/7, etc., ready to fire their weapons. One U.S. Ohio submarine, nuclear-armed submarine, if it fires its load of nuclear weapons, that equals 1,266 Hiroshima bombs from one submarine.
You can read the Nuclear Weapons Ban Monitor yourself. It's a goldmine of information on nuclear weapons and the TPNW. Just search for Nuclear Weapons Ban Monitor and Norwegian People's Aid on the internet. This is Alistair Burnett, ending this news roundup for Nuclear Hot Seat.
That was our monthly ICANN update with Alistair Burnett, and you can learn more about ICANN and the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons on their website, icanw.org. Here's this week's featured interview. Is a freelance journalist based in the San Francisco Bay Area, specializing in covering environmental justice issues. He has a master's degree in journalism and mass communication from Kent State University in his native region of Northeast Ohio, where he also served on the May 4th task force. He won a Lone Star Award for investigative reporting from the Houston Press Club in 2010 for his San Antonio Current story on the city's Toxic Triangle area. He is a member of the Society of Environmental Journalists and is also a contributing editor with Pop Matters. Here, we start with issues in Northeast Ohio, but as you will hear, the story soon spreads to many other locations. I spoke with Greg Schwartz on April 18, 2026. Greg Schwartz, great to have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks, glad to be here.
What is your background as a journalist?
I started off as a radio reporter intern with the KPFA Evening News for a year in Berkeley, California. That was a great experience working there. Told me I could get into Cal's graduate journalism school, but even though I got a sparkling recommendation from KPFA, I still couldn't get in there. And so I wound up going back home to my native region of Northeast Ohio to go to the program at Kent State, where I earned a master's degree in journalism and mass communication in 2006. It was while I was there that I worked with an activist who other reporters were already calling the Erin Brockovich of Ohio when I met her. That's Chris Borello from Concerned Citizens of Lake Township. And her group still is trying to get environmental justice at the Industrial Excess Landfill Superfund site in Uniontown, which is near Canton, Ohio. Yeah, I worked with her for over a year on a story about the cover-up at this landfill and learned a lot about investigating crooked science and data manipulation at the EPA, and found that there is a really bad case of regulatory capture going on at the EPA, regardless of which party occupies the White House. The big polluters and the military that are responsible for the toxic waste at these Superfund sites across the country. And they don't want to have to pay for the more expensive and time-consuming cleanups. So if they can cut corners with crooked science and data manipulation to show that the toxic contaminants, whatever they may be, are below maximum contaminant levels, then they can get a quicker corner-cutting cleanup over a much costlier, much more time-consuming proper cleanup.
You mentioned the problem at Industrial Excess Landfill, or IEL.
Yeah.
What was the source of that problem? And when you discovered it, how well known was it?
Not well known at all outside of Ohio. In fact, it's still not well known outside of Ohio. But what I found was that there are national ramifications at this site, because the EPA had convened a science advisory board to rule on radiation issues. So citizens of this town, Uniontown and Lake Township is right next to it, have long alleged that there was secret military dumping of Cold War weapons waste at this landfill in the late 60s and early 70s. And then it went on to become one of the most toxic Superfund sites in the country in the 80s. And the EPA has gone through all kinds of mental gymnastics to dispel this notion. It's been a very controversial site for decades, and found that they have engaged in all kinds of, if they find something they don't like, they say, oh, you know what, that was invalid, we'll have to do it again. And they keep doing it until they get the results they want. I found that that science advisory board was not even really qualified to rule on radiation issues by their own admission. I mean, the majority of them admitted this to me. Yet this board was tasked with making recommendations for how to handle radiation at similar sites around the country. The IEL had been deemed a case in point, and that was told to me directly by EPA attorney Tim Thurlow in a phone interview 20 years ago. And so we found that they've kind of institutionalized this playbook for crooked science and data manipulation, and it's going on around the country. So there's lessons to be learned from the IEL that can be applied at other sites. But I believe this cover-up has been deemed too big to fail due to the massive liability and embarrassment for both the EPA and the DOE if it was discovered that they knowingly dumped this radioactive waste there and, you know, are allowing it to seep into the watershed.
Was this waste from local manufacturing? Was it shipped in? Where did it come from?
There's a lot of waste there from big polluters like the Akron rubber companies, but this nuclear waste, we believe, is from the military, and that there's an attorney who, there were court cases in the 90s with people who died of cancer and their families sued, and they settled and the documents were sealed. An expert witness named Dr. Robert Simon, who told the Akron Beacon Journal or one of the other regional papers that he saw documents in discovery indicating that nuclear weapons waste had been dumped there. And there was another person who said it looked like a small Rocky Flats, which was the nuclear site in Colorado with the waste. But the EPA doesn't want to admit this. So anytime there was a detect of plutonium or something, you'd say, no, this isn't right. We have to do it again. They've managed to jump through all kinds of hoops to, they say, keep the site in compliance. And then they changed the record of decision for the cleanup and decided just to go with monitored natural attenuation, which is just basically dilution. We investigated this site for more than a year. I investigated this site for more than a year with her help. Got this story published in the Cleveland Free Times in 2006 titled Buried Secrets. And then, you know, I thought I was done with the story because I thought I took it as far as I could.
We hear a lot about the nuclear waste problems at Piketon, Portsmouth.
Yeah.
And that's being covered very extensively by Jason Sally down there, doing a great job reporting, yeah, and with a lot of backup from Vinakalia Press and from Pat Morita, who's coordinator of Ohio Nuclear Free Network. Is there a connection between the problems down there and what is being faced in Northeast Ohio?
I'd say loosely, yes. It's the problem that, you know, Uncle Sam and the military-industrial complex still don't really know what to do with the waste from nuclear production processes, right? They don't have a place to stash the stuff, yet they want to build all these new plants. And in this case, it seemed like maybe they had something hot that they needed to dump real quick, and they thought they could get away with it at this obscure landfill. Dumped it there, and the landfill owner, Charles Kittinger, later testified that they came in and dumped these big metal plutonium eggs there and told him not to tell anyone. They told him not to talk about it. 30 years later, he came forward in 2001, and there was a secret Department of Justice probe into this matter, with federal judge John Manos ultimately ruling that he felt Kittinger's testimony wasn't credible, but that was very flimsy. And I've come to see a pattern where the Department of Justice comes in to look like they're being tough watchdogs, but then helps sweep Department of Energy or NRC's crimes under the rug, which is what we saw at Rocky Flats when they convened the grand jury there and then squelched it. And then we've seen the Department of Justice come in at Hunter's Point in San Francisco to join the lawsuits against Tetra Tech, yet now that's been kind of swept under the rug. Tetra Tech got a fine of $97 million or something like that, but they make far more than that every year on new contracts from the EPA. And so Tetra Tech is a big player here as a environmental cleanup testing contractor with the EPA.
Has Tetra Tech been assigned the cleanup, or are they responsible for having made the mess in the first place?
No, they're just one of the contractors that the EPA likes to use, and they use them increasingly more and more. Now, I wasn't familiar with Tetra Tech back in 2006 when I was first working on a story. And then it wasn't until years later, you know, Chris Borrello, her determination is quite incredible. She always told me that she thought I was going to come back to this IEL story someday, and I was skeptical. I felt we'd taken as far as we could. And then one day in 2018, she digs up a 20-year-old press release from the Project on Government Oversight in Washington, D.C., asking, why is the EPA rehiring this contractor named PRC/Tetra Tech at the IEL in Ohio when they'd already been found to have made numerous mistakes in groundwater sampling protocols at the site? And I'm out here in the Bay Area reading this list of mistakes, and a light bulb goes on in my head, because the mistakes were similar to what whistleblowers had reported about another Tetra Tech subsidiary called Tetra Tech EC in the massive eco-fraud scandal at the former Hunters Point Naval Shipyard in San Francisco, where they were responsible for trying to help remediate the site and were found to have falsified soil samples. And two supervisors were convicted and sent to prison, yet Tetra Tech Incorporated claimed that these two supervisors were merely rogue employees acting on their own. And they've been able to get away with pushing that contrived narrative.
And clarify, what is the situation at Hunter's Point? You talked about the contamination there, but what is the nature of the nuclear contamination, and where did that come from?
Well, that came from the fact that it was a Navy site where ships from World War II would come back to be cleaned from radioactive activities with nuclear weapons. And they also had a nuclear research lab there. So the place is very contaminated, and they're trying to remediate it to turn it over to the city of San Francisco for hugely lucrative real estate developments because the site is right on the bay. And if it wasn't contaminated, it would be, you know, very valuable real estate. But it's actually a historically poor black neighborhood. But now they're trying to spruce it up and they've made an artist colony there. And so it's still a very controversial cleanup. And especially because of Tetra Tech getting busted for the fraudulent remediation there. And now they have other contractors resurveying this stuff. And they're still trying to, like, get it cleaned up so that they can pass it off to the city. But so I thought if I go back down that rabbit hole at the IEL, I'm probably going to find evidence to suggest that, no, these weren't rogue supervisors. This is a pattern with you guys, with the crooked science and the data manipulation. And so I wound up spending another 2 years on what became a 5-part series that was published in the San Francisco Bayview in 2020. There was a deep dive on the cover-up at the IEL with a follow-up story connecting dots to Hunter's Point. And I think I touched a nerve because Tetra Tech sent a letter threatening to sue the SF Bayview for defamation if they didn't retract my series.
Oh, you must have stepped on some really big toes with that one.
Yes, yes. And so that was quite a moment. And the publisher of the SF Bayview, she was great about it, Mary Ratcliffe. She told me, Greg, I always say you can measure the strength of your reporting by the virulence of the opposition. And Tetra Tech threatening to sue is pretty virulent. She insisted that they were bluffing and there was no way they were going to sue this little community newspaper. So I consulted with some legal experts, the Reporters Committee from Freedom of the Press. I talked to them. I talked to an attorney in Ohio who was familiar with the IEL saga. He advised me to stand pat on the strength of the reporting in the series. And that's ultimately what we decided to do. And Tetra Tech backed down and went away.
So you've seen this pattern of cover-up, of collusion between the EPA, the military, the sites themselves,
yeah,
in two locations. Now you're also writing about Diablo Canyon. How does that fit into this patterning?
Diablo Canyon, I would say, is another case of regulatory capture and collusion, but in a different way. It's not the testing from the EPA. It's the collusion between the NRC and PG&E because, well, they colluded to sweep newer seismic data under the rug since if they admitted it, it would indicate that this plant is unsafe and vulnerable to a stronger earthquake than it's built to withstand. They have to shut it down for hugely expensive safety upgrades, which they didn't want to do. And so they railroaded the former senior on-site safety inspector, Michael Peck. They railroaded him out of there for writing a dissenting professional opinion that exposed what he called criminal regulatory collusion to sweep this newer seismic data under the rug. I interviewed him first in 2015 after getting a tip from someone at Friends of the Earth who I was talking to about the Fukushima contamination. And that person said, you should check out Diablo Canyon, which is poised to become an American version of the Fukushima disaster because of regulatory collusion to sweep seismic data under the rug that shows it's vulnerable. Even though it's a long shot, it was also long odds at Fukushima. Yeah, Diablo Canyon is built on some fault lines. And in 2008, they discovered new fault lines and new danger. And they say it's the most studied site in the world. And maybe it is. But this collusion has taken place. You know, they agreed to shut down Diablo Canyon in 2018. And so I thought, oh, the story's over. I don't have to worry about that anymore. But then in 2022, Governor Gavin Newsom rammed through a bill to keep it going. And I thought, oh no, I've got to talk to Michael Peck again. I felt sort of a Frodo Baggins type weight of the world on my shoulders about it because, you know, if I don't do it, who's going to do this? So I get Michael Peck back on the phone and he tells me, yes, he's got all his same concerns and that he'd been trying to FOIA the NRC every year to get the inspector general's report on their investigation into his allegations of the regulatory collusion. He thought they were stonewalling him, and I asked him to send me what they'd sent him, and I saw that they'd only said it wasn't ready yet, not that he couldn't have it. So I filed a FOIA request, and I got that report. They might have quietly published it on an NRC site, but I got the inspector general's report and I showed it to Michael Peck and he pointed out that it was filled with holes and at least one huge fabrication where his boss told the IG that PEC's concerns are only about kind of regulatory nitpicking and not actual safety danger issues. And he said, no, it wasn't an immediate safety issue, but it was certainly an ongoing safety issue of concern about an earthquake that could cause a meltdown like at Fukushima. This report is still very under the radar. Very few people have reported, I don't know of anyone else that has reported on this NRC IG report that has the holes in it. And so San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace, they've been doing great activism out there to try to get Diablo shut down and expose these dangers. I did another story on Diablo at the end of 2025, again, highlighting Michael Peck's concerns and the seismic dangers from other experts concerned as well. Plus the fact that Diablo Canyon, they tried to tell us we need it for energy grid stability out here, but that's not really true either. I interviewed an energy expert who works with the Sierra Club, who explained in great detail why we don't really need Diablo Canyon. Yet, it makes a lot of money for PG&E and their investors. And so it gets back to this capitalism and collusion. And now the NRC, you have the Trump regime's Department of Energy has waged a hostile takeover of the NRC, which was already a handmaiden to the nuclear industry. But now they want to grease the skids even more, cut corners for more profiteering, and continue cutting corners on safety. And this is a real concerning situation, both at Diablo Canyon and really around the country with what the Trump DOE is doing to try to ramp up their nuclear renaissance.
We'll continue with the second half of our interview with reporter Greg Schwartz in just a moment. But first, it's endless, isn't it? Nuclear betrayals, be they weapons, manufacturing, uranium mining, radioactive waste, the deck is stacked against people, the planet, life on Earth. And it's amazing how all-pervasive the nuclear compromises to our future are. Can one person, one podcast make a difference? Only one way to find out, and that's to keep Nuclear Hot Seat going. Since June 14 of 2011, only 3 months after the Fukushima nuclear disaster began, Nuclear Hot Seat has been covering nuclear issues, an hour of information, every week. We do our best to provide only verifiable information, genuine experts, and actionable steps that any one of us can take to help turn this nuclear juggernaut around. Is it daunting? Yes. Is this work effective? Ultimately, only time will tell. But we must do everything we can, while we can, and not give up, no matter how much money, PR propaganda, and denigrating bots get thrown at us. The alternative is to guarantee that nothing gets done to prevent accidents, nuclear war, uncontrolled contamination from radioactive waste, the kinds of things that doom humanity to a future of cancer, genetic damage, birth defects, autoimmune diseases, and so much more. And that is why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. We unconditionally support the movement to get rid of nuclear weapons and the nuclear reactors that support them and the collusive industries that go into their creation. To that end, every week, we call out the nuclear lies and liars through interviews and news stories, while letting you know what frontline activists and movements are doing about these many transgressions. We provide verifiable nuclear news so that you can understand the issues, the manipulations, and what you can do about it. But in order to keep this show going, we need your help. Nuclear Hot Seat runs on donations, and we're always in need of support. Be it a one-time donation of any amount or a recurring donation of as little as $5, the same as you would spend here in the U.S. for a nice cup of coffee, all of it counts towards our monthly expenses. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donations are tax deductible. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com, and we get that without any fees being taken out. So don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate right now, and know that whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here is part two of our interview with reporter Greg Schwartz on the Environmental Protection Agency's nuclear collusion. You've spoken about the playbook that is used by the nuclear industry, by the NRC, by the military, by all of them in moving this forward. Give us a sense of what that playbook actually consists of. Not that it's written out anywhere, but these seem to be the standards and practices that they follow and default to under all circumstances that might be a threat to their bottom line, their dollar income.
Yeah. Well, that playbook that I talked about, it was not in relation to the NRC. It's the playbook that the EPA uses at the Superfund sites. And it's not just Tetra Tech. It's the others, other contractors that use similar schemes for crooked science and data manipulation that based around where you test, when you test, how stringently you test, how long do you run the samples for. And so seeing the connections between how they implemented the cover-up at the IAEA in Ohio and how some similar schemes were used at Hunter's Point in San Francisco, that was a real eye-opener. And now I see, we've seen that they've also been catching some flack for similar crooked science in East Palestine in Ohio. That's not nuclear, but again, it's trying to clean up a toxic disaster. And so there is a connection there. Tetra Tech, once again, is on the site there. The Government Accountability Project is getting ready to go after them for some crooked science and data manipulation. They've got a whistleblower who has reported some of that. And so I'll give you the best, most disturbing example of the crooked science at the IEL. A great example of the crooked science in the groundwater testing and sampling at the IEL in Ohio. It goes back to the year 2000. They were doing another round of sampling to look for nuclear contamination, plutonium in this case. They take a groundwater sample. They send it to a lab that uses a device called a mass spectrometer to measure radioactivity and what might be there and how much there is. Somehow, Chris Borrello and Concerned Citizens of Lake Township obtained some of this data. One of the graphs showed what looked like a potential plutonium hit. And I showed this to a DOE radiochemist named Dave Sill, one of the top radiochemists in the world at the time. Unfortunately, he passed away a few years back. He looked at this and we were on the phone in 2019. He tells me, Greg, they only counted this for 3 hours. A DOE standard would be overnight, about 16 hours. I think from what I see here, if they had kept counting that overnight, it would have been a statistically positive hit for plutonium-239 in the morning, but they only counted it for 3 hours. And then the EPA will jump through these hoops where they'll say, well, it's more resource intensive. There needs to be a good reason to use these resources and spend that money. So the thing at the IEL is they try to say they don't have reason to believe that there was man-made nuclear isotopes dumped there since it's not in the network of such sites. And that's where you get back to the secret dumping that they don't want to admit and why the cover-up, I believe, has been deemed too big to fail. And so they can get away with saying we don't need to look for that stuff because we have no good reason to suspect that it's there. And that's something that Chris Borrello and Concerned Citizens of Lake Township have continued to harp on, and with good reason. In 2002, the EPA changed the remedy. You know, they were supposed to do a pump and treat system, and they said, no, it's all good. The plume's going away. We can just go with monitored natural attenuation, which is techno speak for dilution is the solution to the pollution, right? Which is they're also trying to do out in Fukushima now, dilute the water and just let it into the ocean.
Which is a completely discredited platform.
Yes, and I've reported on that as well, because I find that very disturbing. And it's a huge Pandora's box, letting this radioactive wastewater into the ocean. You know, they say it's okay, but they don't really know. It's never been done before.
Where are you working now, or who are you reporting for? And to what extent are you able to continue to present the information that you're finding about IEL in northeastern Ohio?
Unfortunately, I'm just a freelancer now. The collapse of the journalism industry has put tens of thousands of journalists out of work, and there's not a great market for deep dive environmental reporting because it takes a lot of time and it's difficult. So I'm a freelancer. I write for Counterpunch, Enviro News, and I do these stories in my spare time, which is, you know, difficult to do while working another day job. And so I try to focus on the stories where I have some previous expertise, I think enables me to connect dots and see things that a lot of mainstream reporters report on sites like Diablo Canyon. They don't even get into it because they just are trained to sort of trust the NRC and believe them when they say, oh yeah, this is the most studied site in the world. It's all good. And you know, if you don't know what to look for, how would you know? And so, yeah, I'd like to be a full-time investigative reporter again, but that's just not in the cards right now.
Well, hopefully it will be soon because this is an important story. I asked before, but I'd really like to know, is this an issue of concern for the community in a way that they are aware that they are stirred up, that there is some ongoing coverage or representation of it, or has it been buried to the extent that it really isn't visible to most people in that area?
In Uniontown, Ohio, around the industrial excess landfill, there was a lot of regional reporting in the 80s and 90s and into the 2000s. But then EPA basically closed the book on it in 2002 when they amended the record of decision and they put out this responsiveness summary in which they went through all kinds of mental gymnastics to shoot down all the scientific criticisms from the Project on Government Oversight and every other independent consultant that CCLT had worked with. And POGO, to their credit, they really went far. Their executive director, Danielle Bryan, she put together a huge report on problems in the Superfund program, focusing on the IEL as a problem child case in point, and presented that to Congress in 2002 when she testified. And that was also, unfortunately, the same year that the EPA railroaded Ombudsman Bob Martin out of his position, and he resigned in disgust because they were taking away his independence, and they wrapped the ombudsman's role into the inspector general's office so that they had their own thumb on it.
Explain what the ombudsman was supposed to do, what his position was, and what he was taken out of.
Yeah, the EPA ombudsman was a position where citizens could ask for further oversight. And Bob Martin was recommending that they do some trenching at IEL and other sites. So he was a real watchdog, and that's not what the EPA wanted. And so I think they came to the conclusion they needed to get rid of that position, which is basically what they did. Technically, they said it still existed, but again, they wrapped it into the inspector general's office. And he wrote an editorial where he resigned on Earth Day of 2002, which you can find on, I think it was at Grist. You can Google that. I link to it in my stories. And so they get rid of him, and then there is no resource like that for citizens anymore. The EPA is like, trust the science. But again, it all comes down to where are they testing? How often are they testing? What testing methods are they using? You always got to ask, and they're reluctant to give up this information. They'll try to say they're using a third party. At Hunter's Point, they tell us, we're using an independent third party to review this information. Well, who's the independent third party? Oh, it's Battelle. Battelle, who is a longtime partner of the DOE and the Navy, right? They're not an independent third party. They're a collaborator. Also, NARAL, right? The National Aeronautical Radiological Lab of the EPA in Alabama. They were involved at the IEL where their guy, John Griggs, was saying, well, it's resource intensive to do this kind of testing, you need to have a reason. And now they're sending the Hunter's Point data validation samples to NARAL, which to me gets a red flag where I'm asking them for this information and waiting to see if they'll give it to me or if I have to file another FOIA request to get it. And so there's all kinds of things they can do with the data to massage it to get what they want. You know, the contractors, unfortunately, they are in a position where they want to give the EPA what they want in order to win more contracts. And that's a corrupt flaw in the system. that encourages shortcuts and corner cutting, even though the Trump EPA recently issued a press release where they claim their dedication to gold standard science and no shortcuts and transparency after they claim that a Tetra Tech subcontractor was guilty of some data manipulation at East Palestine. And oh, we caught it, and we're being such environmental watchdogs in East Palestine. But we're wondering, you know, it's just a scapegoat situation. Why would they even admit this? And that's something that trying to look into now. And so the Superfund program is set up so that the polluters are supposed to pay for the cleanup, but they wound up putting the polluters in charge of the cleanups also. And so you have the wolf watching the hen house. It is a very deep rabbit hole at the IEL. And then you see these similar cover-ups going on at Superfund sites around the country.
Have you ever been in touch with Jason Sally, who is just this ferocious bulldog around Piketon, Portsmouth, and the issues down there? Have you tried reaching out to him or maybe collaborating with him in some way?
I don't think so. I think someone who, well, Chris Borrello was talking to some of the reporters in Ohio and Pennsylvania. Yeah, you know, I know that there's a lot of concern at ports right now because they're trying to crank up some more nuclear production there, and they still haven't cleaned up the waste that they had before. And so they're going to continue to try to sweep that stuff under the rug because they want to crank up new nuclear production. And then you have that huge mess out at the Hanford site in Washington, which is another potential disaster waiting to happen. So, yeah, we're in a very precarious place right now. The NRC was already a captured agency, and now with this DOE hostile takeover, the situation is probably worse than ever before.
With this wealth of information you have about what is, I think, for most of us, an obscure or thus far obscure nuclear story, what are you working on now? Is there a story? Is there a series? Is there a report? And can you talk about it?
You know, I still digging into this thing at the IEL because I like to compare it to that movie Dark Waters with Mark Ruffalo as the attorney who was suing DuPont over their toxic pollution in West Virginia. And that was a saga that played out for more than 20 years before they finally won the case and got some environmental justice. And so, you know, I'd still like to help deliver some environmental justice there at the IEL. But I feel like harping on the crooked science and data manipulation that we've already discovered, it's not going to move the needle because they've already been able to like execute their mental gymnastics to sweep that under the rug. We need new evidence, new whistleblowers. We really need new whistleblowers to come forward about what's going on there. Like the whistleblowers did at Tetra Tech, with Tetra Tech at Hunter's Point. That's how we found out about that. There were whistleblowers who came forward. And now you have a whistleblower coming forward in East Palestine, Scott Smith. I just talked with him and the Government Accountability Project recently and might be working on a story about that with them because I feel like if we can highlight how this is crooked science and data manipulation is going on in East Palestine, Ohio, which is a current site that everyone knows about, that could be a window to showing connecting the dots to sites like the IEL. Again, you have this crooked science playbook. And we saw this at East Palestine in 2023 when the Huffington Post reported on how groundwater samples weren't being properly preserved in the field, which was right out of the playbook at the IEL and something that had gone on there with Tetra Tech and other contractors. And so, yeah, it's so brazen. They feel like they can get away with this stuff because there aren't very many people who have the expertise to recognize it when they see it or even know what to look for in the first place. So I'm looking at a story on East Palestine, looking at another story on the IEL. You know, I'm always looking for where else can I connect the dots and try to expose what's going on at the EPA and, of course, now with the NRC. Those are kind of two separate but parallel issues because the nuclear waste gets created and then there's toxic waste sites and the EPA has to help cover it up. Unfortunately, they're supposed to be protecting us. But again, it just gets back to the regulatory capture and the corruption of wanting that quicker corner-cutting cover-up over the much costlier and much more time-consuming proper cleanup. And we're spending all this money on nuclear modernization. The amount of money we're wasting on nuclear weapons is absolutely insane. Weapons we can never use. And that money could be used to actually do proper cleanups around the country. But that's not profitable to the powers that be. So that's not what's happening.
One of the guests we've had regularly on the show is a marine biologist in the UK, Tim Deer Jones. And we were talking very early on about finding out how much radioactivity was in the water from Fukushima.
Yes.
And he was explaining how many variables there were that would determine what are the currents doing, where's the wind blowing, at what depth was the water taken.
Yeah.
What was the temperature? Was this from sediment? Was this after a storm? Was this before a storm? There are all these different variables that have to be taken into consideration if one is to do honest science on anything to do with a body of water and radioactivity.
Indeed.
And it sounds like you're running up against the exact same set of issues. He does much more with the oceans and with the rivers and around the UK. But it's the same set of issues.
It is similar. And it's interesting you bring him up, because I talked to Tim Deer Jones a couple of years ago about the Fukushima situation and reported a story on that for Counterpunch. I was put in touch with him by another activist that we were mutual acquaintances with. Yeah, I did a story on concern about the contamination at Fukushima, plus whistleblowers that were being squelched. This is a story that was very underreported in the mainstream media. There were whistleblowers saying that there was regulatory collusion going on between the Japanese government and the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, to approve this process, to let the TEPCO plant in Japan go ahead with their scheme to release the wastewater into the Pacific Ocean, and that there were whistleblowers, a couple whistleblowers coming forward say that no, they fudged the data, they fudged the report, and this was largely swept under the rug. This is a story I reported at the end of 2023. It was titled "The Radioactive Pacific Ocean: Is the IAEA Hiding Dangers of Releasing Fukushima's Radioactive Wastewater into the Pacific Ocean?" And Tim Deer Jones was one of the people I talked to about this. And the Fukushima 311 Watchdogs blog first reported on these documents, that internal documents leaked by a purported IAEA whistleblower suggesting corrupt regulatory collusion between TEPCO, Japan's government, and the IAEA to spin the final report in order to downplay the potential dangers and enable the wastewater release plan to proceed. Well, again, this is an international problem. They do it in the nuclear industry. Wherever things go wrong, they have to downplay it, or else people aren't going to want nuclear facilities anywhere near where they live. As well, they shouldn't.
Do you have anything that we haven't covered that you'd like to mention at this time?
That's always a good question to ask at the end of an interview. Yeah, you know, I came to develop this expertise on crooked science and data manipulation in the EPA Superfund program. I won a Lone Star Award from the Houston Press Club for my story on San Antonio's toxic triangle area, where I saw a similar thing going on. And that was not nuclear contamination. That was toxic plumes from the former Kelly Air Force Base that were causing cancers and birth defects in the poor Mexican-American neighborhood nearby. Again, you always want to watch out if they tell you they put together a blue ribbon panel to examine the evidence, because you'll usually find a conflict of interest. Where I did down there, there was a guy who was connected to the Air Force on the panel. San Antonio is a military town. That's where their main economy is. They don't want to rock the boat there with the Air Force. And then I saw that in Los Angeles with the methane gas leak at Porter Ranch, the Aliso Canyon gas leak in 2015. You know, the residents were complaining about all these health problems, and they had the LA County Department of Health chief come out there to try to tell people, don't go see your doctor, come see our doctor. And he was getting involved, trying to sweep those problems under the rug. And so you can't really trust your local health department, unfortunately, because the powers that be will infiltrate there to get at the people that can help assuage the situation. And, you know, we're still wondering in San Francisco, is the Department of Health really watching out for what's going on at Hunter's Point? Or, you know, how high does the corruption go? Does City Hall, there's long been suspicions that everyone, all the different mayors, from Willie Brown to Gavin Newsom and also with Nancy Pelosi and Kamala Harris and everyone, because there's so much money at stake still. And these real estate developments, at Hunter's Point, they want to get that done and pass it off to the city. And so the Navy is still there, still trying to clean this up, still trying to tell us things are going well. Yet, you know, you have to wonder, are they still using the same playbook to cut corners? And unfortunately, anytime that much money is at stake, that's probably what they're going to try to do. So, yeah, I'm still looking into Hunter's Point, still digging into the IEL cover-up. We have one whistleblower who said that the judge admitted the cover-up to her off the record, former reporter, but then it's so complicated when you get off-the-record commentary that you want to use. We tried to approach the Canton repository to let their former reporter talk about this, and their editors wouldn't allow it. And so it goes on and on and on.
Well, it's good to know that there's someone as dogged and as knowledgeable as you working on these stories as best you can, given the journalistic environment that we're all under these days.
Yeah.
As things develop on any of these stories, please keep us in the loop so that we can help inform the listeners.
Sure.
And for now, I want to thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks.
Reporter Greg Schwartz. We will have a link up to several of the articles he mentioned during this interview, including the three-part series on the Industrial Excess Landfill Superfund site in Northeast Ohio. This will be on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 773.
Activists, shout out.
There is an urgent action alert from physicist Linda Williams. She wrote, "The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC, wants to replace its independent safety review with secret Department of Energy and Dow approvals, letting companies use a small test nuclear reactor safety permit to license a full commercial scale one, possibly dozens, clustered at a data center coming to a community near you. This will exclude public oversight and legal action. This must be stopped," Linda wrote. Comments are needed by May 4th. She includes sample wording, which is, quote, "I oppose docket NRC 2025-1503. Independent NRC safety review cannot be replaced by secret DOE or Dow authorizations the public cannot access or challenge." Easy peasy. We will have a link up to where you can voice your concerns on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 773. And remember, comments are needed by May 4th. In closing, this has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, April 21st, 2026. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, just sign up. It's easy. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, look for the yellow opt-in box, put in your first name and an email address, and every week you will get sent one email with a link to that week's show as soon as it posts and a short description of its content. It's the easiest and surest way to make certain that you don't miss a single episode of the show. And you can help us with our stories. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that to us in an email at info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your support, so thank you. Any amount will help us out, and we are always deeply grateful for any help we get. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2026, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat reminding you, dilution is not the solution to pollution. No matter how much the nuclear industry loves that little lying slogan, dilution just spreads the problem over a larger area without affecting its power to harm us. It is not a genuine solution to anything. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.